Welcome to This Week in Money. I'm Jim Goddard. Today, Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com runs down the major markets. He tells us what the rolling tops in New York equities mean. He takes a look at the U.S. and Canadian dollars, crude, and gold. Publisher of the trendletter.com, Martin Strath, weighs in on the panic hitting the stock market, interest rates, and how governments claim to be trying to fight inflation while they're the ones fueling it. WolfStreet.com's Wolf Richter checks in from San Francisco to talk about reckless fiscal policies and how deficit spending is no longer the right thing to do by governments in a time of high interest rates. Plus, at the end of the show, we'll have a company showcase update from Shaheem Ali, Chief Financial Officer for Recyclical Battery Materials. We'll talk to Ross Clark right after this.
Introducing Recyclical, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclical's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclical Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB, AMYZF, and Frankfurt 2AM. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
Welcome to This Week in Money, the source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com, where you'll find insightful commentary and timely technical analysis. You can find him on Twitter at ChartsByRoss. Welcome back to the show.
Good to be with you, Jim.
Ross, again, a very tumultuous, turmoil-filled American stock market. What can you tell us there?
Yeah, the end of the calendar quarter is closing down right on the lows. You know, we spent the early part of the week, the market got hit, then went into a tight trading range, and then by Friday it decided to give it up. So the S&P's were at 3590 to close off the week. And the normal retracement they've been looking at since the November high was going to be a 50% retracement from the what I call the COVID low, that March of 2020 low. And S&P at 3590 is getting close. 3500 is a pretty good target, I think, for this break. And, you know, we've been looking, and I published a piece in the last day or two, looking at these rolling tops. Typically, equity markets, you don't have that spike high that you get in commodities. You tend to get a distribution pattern on the and on a few individual stocks, they'll spike. But in general, when you look at the indices, they've got this rolling pattern as the distribution goes on. So from November, December, we've got these tops retraced back nicely in, you know, like 60, 70% retracements in the February window. But as of July, the everything started to get, you know, pretty heavy. The rallies were coming back on these indices, on the broad indices, just back to the 200-day moving average. And the average had time to peak and roll over, so we were kissing from the lower side. And when we look back, we've got a good half a dozen examples since 1960 that are like this. Actually, the one that really jumps out is 1929, where in 1930 the market had the retracement rally like we had in August of this year. And then in all these examples, they've gone from kissing that 200-day to going down and just taking out the supporting low. In this case, that would be the June-July low. Take that out, thrash around for a while, maybe have a 50% retracement rally. Could be as little as 38% from the August high. And that becomes the next really good selling opportunity. So we put the guidelines together in a piece this week, and so far it looks as though the modeling is pretty much on track for, say, a reasonable pause here in, let's call it, the next 2 to 4 weeks, and then down and dirty after that again.
Well, Gordon Lightfoot's song, The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald, said, it's bad when the storms in November come early. Is that what we're looking for in the markets? Relative calm now, and then real churny stormy weather that just might take your ship down with it?
I think so. A lot of people that I've talked to, they're getting a little antsy, but not that many people have taken money out of the market. They're still, they're saying, oh, I'm down X amount off the high, and, I'm not going to sell down here. I'm not going to take this kind of a loss. I'm going to wait until it rallies back, and then I'll sell. Well, you know what happens. When it rallies back, they'll decide that the market's back in a bull market phase, and they won't want to sell into the high. So at this point, I think that there's still a fair amount of too much pessimism that has not found itself into liquidation. So that'll be the key here when we start to see that the volumes really pick up. And I'd like to see things like the VIX, the volatility index, currently that's around 31. And we've got some, the highs in VIX, the volatility, are generally, timed with lows in the equity markets. And we use our various technicals, to generate signals on that. Don't have anything there right now. We would have to see a pretty good pop in this next week or so, to give an extreme on the VIX, and therefore maybe the bottom of this part of the move, and ready for the bounce that could be 38 to 50% from August highs.
On the currency markets, the U.S. dollar remains the elephant in the room. It's the strongest critter out there. The Canadian dollar taking it on the chin, but how's it doing compared to other currencies? We always compare ourselves to the U.S., but what about the rest of the world? Are we still in some kind of a decent territory?
Yeah, you look at, the Canadian dollar is 72.30. That's, a pretty bad number here. But you take a look, the British pound, they did the big move with the interest rates in the middle of the week. Pound had bottomed at 103.60, and it's back at 111.5. That's shut out the week here. And, if you take a look at things like, the Japanese yen, that one is been as weak probably as Canada at this point. So, I don't think that you could say that the Canadian dollar has held its own against anything to speak of, other than, that big move in interest rates in the pound. There's no way that this Canadian dollar has got anything that would say that it's doing well. We do have capitulation on our indices on the daily basis on Tuesday through Friday. So definitely seeing some excesses here. I mean, when we talked a week ago, we had just broken 76, and here we are pushing towards 72. So panic is really definitely set into the currency markets on the Canadian dollar. It's interesting, the U.S. dollar has had a reasonably, good reversal this week. We had upside exhaustion signals a week ago. I probably mentioned that at the time. And so we've reversed from just shy of 115 now down to 112 on the index. Good support, I think, would be on the 50-day moving average, and that's rising up underneath. So probably about 110 would be the reasonable target as far as the pullback in the U.S. dollar is concerned.
What's happening with crude?
Crude, the model that we use on the 10-year cycle, there was an ABC correction from the highs. The target for the sea leg down was 76 and change. That happened within the last week. And we've now had the first bounce off the low. We're looking at just under 80 now, closed at 79.74. This bounce. And, you know, it hasn't been too bad so far. 76 up to 81 has been the move. But the rally, and I think we still have more left in terms of the rally off that $76 low. I want to see that get up and kiss the 50-day moving average. That's going to be probably in the high 80s by the time we get there, because it's a downsloping line. It's just over 90 right now. Give it a few weeks to maybe get there, and you're probably looking at something, as I said, in the high 80s at the best. And that looks as though that would be the next selling opportunity for the oil market.
And for people outside of Vancouver who are shocked when they go to gas up their car, right now we're paying about $2.42 a liter. That's $9.68 per Canadian gallon. The highest prices in North America by far.
It's almost as good as a cheap bottle of wine.
I don't know. I might switch to gasoline. I'm sure it'll give me a huge kick. Now, what's going on with gold right now?
Gold and silver both biding their time down here. And, we've had, gold got down to the 1660 level, during the week. So that was a new low for the last couple of years, marginally lower low. Rallied back, to just kiss the support level. But, we've got, still a lot of overhead here until the dollar peaks out. And I think that as far as the dollar is concerned, if we get that pullback, say, into the 110 range, then I think that the U.S. dollar can continue back up for another leg. And if that happens, gold is going to continue to stay under pressure. Interestingly, silver has held in very nicely. We had some good signals as far as the low was put in place back at the end of August. It rallied up to $20, held above 18 on this break, and closed off at 19. So, if anything, there's a decent looking base starting to form here in the silver market. We're keeping a close eye on that. I think if you can get a close through 20 on the upside, that could be a catalyst for a decent run.
Ross, thank you so much for the update.
Pleasure to be with you, Jim.
My guest has been Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com. Find him on Twitter at chartsbyross. Coming up, Martin Strath next on This Week in Money.
Always consult your investment professional before making any investment decision. Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com. This Week in Money is archived online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Martin Strath, founder of Trend News Online at thetrendletter.com. He's speaking to us from Coquitlam, British Columbia. That's just east of Vancouver. Martin, welcome to This Week in Money.
Thanks, Jim. Good to be here.
Martin, can you tell us a bit about Trend News and how people can sign up for it?
Oh, sure. We publish three investment services. We have the Trend Letter, which started over 20 years ago. I started that when just after the dot-com crash, and a number of my friends and colleagues couldn't understand how I actually made money while they lost a lot. I have a systems background, and I created some models that would trigger buy and sell signals. So I started basically writing a letter for them, and then, you know, put it out on the internet, and 20 years later, here we are. So we have three services. The Trend Letter was that first one, so that comes out every Sunday. Covers equities, currencies, precious metals, commodities, and bonds. It's mostly charts. It's also about 50 pages. But again, it's very easy to get through, and it just has key bullet points to make it very easy to understand. The focus would be for long-term investors who want a better understanding of, you know, what drives these markets. The second service is our Trend Technical Trader. That's an online service that we started as a hedging service. So that's been very timely these days with our subscribers, dealing with this nasty bear market. Our Trend Technical Trader covers many sectors now, including commodities, equities, precious metals, even psychedelic therapies. That's a very exciting new sector, and they just booked a very nice 45% gain in 3 months. The focus here is for traders, but investors certainly can benefit, especially with these hedging strategies. So, very timely for hedging. I encourage everybody to at least have some exit hedging strategies right now. Third one is our disruptors, Trend Disruptors, a monthly publication. Deals with disruptive ideas, artificial intelligence, virtual reality, augmented reality, 5G, cloud, Internet of Things. Very speculative, and so speculative that, we've been in a bear market since January, and we have not added any new recommendations during that market, but we have been building our watch list, which is now up to about 30 companies. So we're starting to, we're giving our subscribers, information about those, but we're not recommending buying them just yet. So that's it. Those are our services. That's what we offer investors to help them be more successful.
Where is market sentiment this week?
Well, let's pick a word. How about frightful, panicked, extremely bearish? It's horrible. All the indicators, the fear and greed index is sitting at extreme fear, put call ratio is high, volatility index is high. The S&P 500 is down 25% since January. This week, we even tested the June low and unfortunately even pushed lower. I know that Friday it's down again. But that's okay. What we're seeing now is our models are indicating that we should see a short-term relief rally soon. The market is oversold. We'd be looking for a short-term rally, maybe up to that 100-day moving average, which is around the 90 or 39.70 range.
Does it look like stock markets have put in a double bottom?
No. Again, anything's possible, Jim, but, more likely to us is just what I said. We'd see a short-term rally, get up to 39.70, but then we would expect another leg down, and that's where we would really suggest people look to have a hedging position. Get prudent here. The last 15 years, most investors are conditioned to think the Fed's going to come to the rescue for any slight economic weakness. But they have to understand that there's a U.S. election here, and the pressure for the Fed is to continue to fight inflation, not save stocks. The Democrats say they're there for the lower and middle class. There's not many lower class heavily into the stock market. So we see central banks continue to raise rates, reducing the balance sheet, which is the opposite of what fueled the bull market. Many are waiting for the Fed to pivot and become more dovish. To us, that's not happening anytime soon. The drivers are inflation, rising rates, slow global economy, likely recession. So you add all that up, and I see that, especially with the recession, that would just escalate a bear market. So we'll see some rallies, Jim, but I don't see a double bottom here at all.
Do stock markets tend to rise alongside interest rates?
Good question. They can, and they have, but the real issue here is that it depends on what's going on in the market. So rising rates, if we get slow, steady, predictable inflation, that's really good for the economy. And so if you get that, you're going to get slowly rising rates. You'll get a rising stock market. So in those scenarios, they can work together. But if you got this nice predictable inflation, it means the economy's growing. That means employment's rising. Wages are also rising. But when you get, in history, what we've seen, I can just name off a few, 2005 to 2007, both rose together, 2009 and 10, 2013 and 14, 2018. And recently, from the pandemic right up to the start of this year, both of those rose. But the problem today, Jim, is that inflation's jumped way too fast. The Fed was way behind it, and now the rates are rising way too quickly. So now what we've got here is we've got a declining stock market in a rising rate market.
What do you see ahead for stock markets heading into 2023?
Well, if we get the recession that I was talking about it earlier, which, by the way, I think the U.S. is already in one. Recessions hurt the equity markets. In recessions, people hold back. You know, prices are falling. People go, well, why buy now? I can wait for cheaper prices. So that hurts companies to get lower sales, less profit. But it really depends on the central banks and particularly the Fed. You know, that today the Fed has signaled they are all in on crushing inflation. You know, the interesting thing is going to be, Jim, what do they do when they realize that they are also crushing the economy? So they're really, you know, they're really between a rock and a hard place here. Debt levels by government and homeowners are really high. High rates will hurt everybody. So I'm thinking that after the U.S. election, the Fed is going to come under some real pressure to ease off the rate increases. It doesn't mean they're going to stop, but I think that they will kind of have to pull back some. We see inflation, though, has been quite sticky, lingering longer than most people expect. But I tell you, once the market senses the Fed is looking to pivot, ease off, you'll see a big jump in the markets. They're always looking forward. There's a great saying on Wall Street, central banks decide when to raise rates, markets decide when to lower them. So I'm suspecting that somewhere around March, April, we'll probably see all this come to a head. But in the meantime, we expect lower lows in the stock market. We do have a list of stocks that we're ready to jump into when our models give a buy signal. But right now, our models are warning us this is not the time. And understand, bear markets can last a couple of years. So we could easily see this go into 2023, if not longer. Key points to remember, in early 2000 to mid-20 or 2002, the NASDAQ had 8 strong relief rallies over 15%. But over that period, the NASDAQ lost 75% during that bear market. So our message is be careful, watch the technical charts, and that's what we do.
How high do you think the Fed could take interest rates?
Well, that's really the $64 trillion question now, isn't it? Predicting what central banks do, that's a real challenge. The problem is because they're almost always wrong in the forecast. You know, the Fed Reserve, they have over 400 PhDs and a budget of over $6 billion. Yet, with all of those resources, they said inflation was transitory. So if you look at all of their forecasts, they're almost always wrong. So it's very challenging really trying to figure out what they're going to do because they tend to get behind things and then they try and catch up. And also one of the big challenges for central banks right now is they're trying to fight inflation at the same time their governments are piling on more stimulus, which in itself is inflationary. You know, the Biden administration just passed that 796-page Inflation Reduction Act, but it is chock full of spending initiatives, and that, again, is inflationary. Here in Canada, Trudeau's doing the same thing. They keep increasing government spending while the Bank of Canada is trying to fight inflation. So far, what's the Fed going to do? Well, Powell has stated that he sees rates going to 4.6%, and currently they're at 3.25%. But the key point from us is that when Powell said benchmark lending rate must be higher than the inflation rate or the real rate that is positive. That's a key point here because the Fed real rate or the Fed inflation rate right now is, or the Fed rate, sorry, right now is 3.25%. But the inflation rate, depending on whether you're looking at CPI, which is 8.3%, or personal consumption expenditure, which doesn't include food or energy, at 6.3%. So either one of those, their real rate is -3% to -5%. So if he sticks to his guns, he will need to keep raising rates to get to that zero real rate. So what you're going to have to see is lower inflation plus higher rates. Employment's another key factor there. So far, the U.S. unemployment is at historic lows, so that's not an issue for the Fed. So while there's a lot of noise, the Fed's going to back off and save the markets, I don't think so. I think what you're going to see is rates continue to rise and until they can get close to that 0%. So is it 4.6? I don't know.
Is Britain's central bank in trouble?
well, they are certainly having their challenges. But again, like all central banks, the Bank of England is fighting inflation. And again, you know, as I just mentioned with the U.S. and Canada, I mean, when the government lowers taxes, which, I mean, we're all for lowering taxes generally, but when you lower taxes, that's inflationary. And the market saw it that way. And so the market acted very negatively because the market then assumed that the Bank of England will have to raise rates much higher and faster. So you add all that together and investors just panicked and they dumped all these British long bonds. And that created a huge problem for the pension funds in the UK. You know, these pension funds are buying bonds on leverage. And as the bonds fail, the pension funds had to liquidate to meet their margin calls, which just added to the drive lower into the bond prices. So the Bank of England then steps in to stabilize the British bond market. See, the problem is when bonds sell off, it threatens the country's ability to borrow. And this is a really big global concern. You know, we've been warning about a coming global sovereign debt crisis for years. And this event in the UK is really telling us we're getting really close to that reality. When the public loses confidence that the government's able to manage the economy, then they're going to start questioning, well, why would I want to own government bonds? And once you see the first sovereign debt default, then watch out, because you're going to see contagion after that. You know, investors will then look around and ask, who's next? So we've been warning our subscribers to stay out of long-term government bonds, all of them. Short-term's fine. I mean, U.S., you can get, I think, 4% on a six-month. But don't get into long-term. And if you are in long-term, look for any rallies to unload those. So what just happened in Britain, I think, is a glimpse of what we're going to see on a big scale. Watch out for Europe. I think they're really primed for disaster. They've been keeping their rates so low for so long. I mean, even negative. They've basically destroyed their bond market. So answer your question, Jim. Yeah, I think all central banks are in trouble.
Could the bond market bubble be bursting?
Ah, great question. Well, governments need to sell bonds in order to finance their massive deficits and debt, right? So the problem for bonds is as the rates rise, the bond prices fall, and nobody wants to buy a falling asset. You know, in Canada, if you bought a 10-year bond a year ago, you're getting 1.2% yield, yet the inflation rate in Canada is 7%. So you're losing 5.8% every year for the next 9 years. Today, the Canadian 10-year's paying around 3%. But still, with a 7% inflation rate, you're still losing 4%. So the question, you know, most people would ask is, why would I want to own these bonds when I'm losing purchasing power every year for 10 years? So who buys these bonds? Well, it's central banks. They're the big purchasers of their own bond. And they've been doing it for over a decade. And they've been doing it because they want to artificially keep rates low. But that's all changing now. So the Fed, which was buying $120 billion per month, $80 billion in treasuries and $40 billion in mortgage-backed securities, but now they've committed to shrinking those holdings by $95 billion per month. So the question is, who is going to step in and fill that massive void? So the value of global bonds plunged last week by $1.2 trillion. The total loss now from the all-time high is $12.2 trillion. Like I said before, we're warning of a global sovereign debt crisis, and we're getting closer and closer to that reality. You know, once we see the first sovereign debt, we see contagion. Investors look around and ask why, and off we go.
Is the Bank of Canada likely to continue raising rates?
Well, the Bank of Canada has been very aggressive in raising rates. It was the first of the top 10 countries to hit 3.25%, very focused on bringing down inflation. But again, similar to the U.S., the real bank rate in Canada is negative. So it's minus 3.75%. So its current rate of 3.25% minus the 7% inflation. So again, they're behind the inflation rate. So much like the Fed, Bank of Canada needs to see the inflation rate drop and rates rise until, again, they get close to that 0% gap. So realistically, we expect that the Bank of Canada is pretty much going to keep in step with the U.S. Fed.
Does it look like the U.S. dollar put in a top this week?
Well, I mean, the U.S. dollar has been on an absolute tear this year. and it's been driving all markets. And, you know, it's a strong U.S. dollar means weaker other currencies, weaker assets, weaker commodities. So, you know, you've got a strong U.S. dollar, Canadian dollar's down, copper's down, oil's down, gold's down. So the U.S. dollar hit a 20-year high just recently. Canadian dollar was down 12%. The British pound down a 37-year low. The yen at a 24-year low. 18 months ago, Jim, we predicted the euro would be at par in 2 years, while it only took 18 months. So last week, we told subscribers that the near term, the U.S. dollar was overbought and overdue for a pullback. We're seeing that now. Central banks, such as the Bank of Japan, the ECB, have been looking to slow the rise of the dollar. So they've been selling U.S. debt and U.S. dollars. So that boosts other currencies, helps other asset classes. So we see a pullback in the U.S. dollar will probably last a few more weeks. But longer term, we still see the U.S. dollar moving higher. We're looking at to the, you know, the 120 level. So for Canada, we look at the Canadian dollar. Our near-term support would be 72 cents. That fails. We're looking at 68 cents. One of the things about currencies you need to understand is that they tend to move longer than seems logical. So any of these trends, you think they should turn, and they take a while. But when they do turn, they tend to turn fairly quickly.
Are commodity prices tied to the value of the U.S. dollar?
Oh, absolutely. You know, the U.S. dollar is still the world reserve currency. So, you know, with such a strong dollar, these commodities, they're much more expensive for countries that have to import them and pay for them in their local currency. So that then creates a negative effect on demand, which drives prices lower. You know, I know that China and Russia, they're trying to work around the U.S. dollar, you know, using other methods. But the bottom line is it's still, the U.S. dollar still drives most commodity markets.
What do you see ahead for crude and gasoline?
Well, oil, we see much higher prices in 2023. You know, it's crazy. We got governments all over pumping these anti-inflation packages, which are incredibly inflationary. And ultimately, are they keeping demand high? So, you know, there's a saying that the solution to high oil prices is high oil prices. So, but with these, you know, these aid packages, they keep trying to keep the, you know, and these caps on the price, they keep kind of keep the prices low, which allows for the demand to stay fairly high. I mean, Germany just announced Friday a $200 billion defense shield package to cap prices. Now, on the supply side, you've got the U.S. Strategic Reserve being depleted. That was supposed to end in October, but they have mysteriously pushed that back to after the election. Smart thinking, I think, because once that's gone, then, I mean, that's artificially keeping the prices or the supply up, so keeping prices down. Now, you've got windfall taxes, severe regulations, so those are disincentives for producers to invest. So, you know, you add all that up, and so long term, we see oil up probably in the 150, even 200 level sometime by the end of next year. Very short term, I could see oil rise with a maybe pullback in the U.S. dollar, but with a recession and the China shutdowns, that should push demand lower. We could see oil down below $70. If we do get that, that could be a really good buy signal. If our models trigger that, then we'll be sending out alerts to our subscribers.
Automakers are making more and more electric vehicles. Is this bullish for the battery metals?
Eventually. And what I mean by that is in a recession combined with a strong U.S. dollar, commodities get hit. But once we get through all that, yeah, I mean, battery metals, and not just the battery metals, but all commodities related to building EVs, plus all the infrastructure that we need, they'll do well. I mean, just as a reference, a single industrial-sized wind turbine can require as much as 3 metric tons of copper and permanent magnets composed of rare earths. Now, it's a complicated formula, though, because the pro-green activists, the ones that want to push for green-only vehicles, they also don't want any mining. So they haven't quite figured out the connection just yet. You know, they want all of this stuff built. They want these batteries. but they don't want any mining. They don't want copper. I mean, I don't know how they're going to get all that. So plus we need a whole new power generation grid that can handle intermittent power. You know, Jim, as the, when the sun doesn't shine and the wind doesn't blow, there's going to be no power from those intermittent sources. We all love clean energy, clean water, but you can't just wish it to happen. You know, my background is in systems and project management, and it is mind-boggling to me that there doesn't seem to be a coordinated, sustainable transition plan to go total green. All we hear are these dreams of total green in 8 to 12 years, no plan. They don't seem to understand that you can't just shut down fossil fuels and put everybody in an EV and expect the power to charge the vehicles to just come out of nowhere. I mean, California is already having power issues and have already told EV owners to refrain from charging their vehicles. So what happens when you get another 10 million EVs on the streets in California? It's crazy. I can't believe that they have all these meetings and discuss all this and nobody puts up their hand and asks, how are we going to do it?
What are your thoughts on gold?
Well, I mean, the precious metals have been really frustrating, certainly since March, not being an inflation hedge at all. Certainly the U.S. dollar has been the major headwind for gold. It just, you know, it had broken down below key support at 1675. Now, it's now recovered to that level. It's starting to move off its oversold technical level. So a rally here is likely. Our model signaled gold is due for a sustained rally in the fall. So this could be it. Needs to break above 1700, then 1740, 1815. Compared to the commodity index, gold's been crushed. But since June, gold is starting to turn that ratio around. And if it can form a bottom here, we could see a really solid rally. I like gold and silver at these levels. We've given subscribers about 5 plays for the gold and silver area. I would look at something like the juniors, the GDXJ would be a good consideration here for gold.
Is silver in sync with gold?
Pretty much. You know, silver generally follows gold. It just tends to move more violently both up and down. So if you're in a bullish trend for the precious metal, silver tends to go much higher. And then when you're in a bearish market, gold falls further down. So they both do tend to move in the same direction. If it's a bull market for metals, silver will probably do better. And if it's a bear market, then silver will do worse. Silver's also obviously struggled since March, but also looking good here. Initial resistance would be at 1985, 2070, and 2225.
How could the heating up of the Russia-Ukraine conflict affect markets?
Well, war is never good for markets. But, you know, markets are forward-looking, so they tend to discount these events as they move along. You know, even with the threat recently of Putin considering nuclear weapons, it didn't even raise the meter. And this week, Putin just annexed a bunch of Ukrainian territories. And again, very little market reaction. You know, I think that the China-Taiwan situation is potentially just as big or even a bigger concern. You know, Biden just recently threatened to defend Taiwan militarily if Russia invades. And that would be a very serious escalation and you know, real potential for a world war, as would a Russian nuclear attack. You know, war has always been used by leaders that are in trouble, and there are a lot of leaders right now that are not very popular. Hopefully we don't get dragged into some serious global war because a few leaders want to divert our attention for how poorly things are economically around here.
Martin, where can people follow you and find out more about Trend News?
They can simply go to thetrendletter.com, so don't forget the "the" in front of it. You can email us at info@thetrendletter.com. Also, you know, they can go to the website. Your listeners can sign up for our free daily headline service. What we do each morning is we review the markets globally. We look at what we see as information investors should be aware of, and we send that out to anybody that signs up for it. We also include a cartoon each day, Jim, which gives much-needed levity each morning, especially in these days. Also, I will post some of the charts and notes that I've got here from our chat, just so your listeners can view them. I'm I'm a big believer that a picture's worth a thousand words, so there you go. Also, at the end of that blog, given this our first time on your podcast, we're offering some great specials for your listeners if they want to subscribe to any of our services.
Martin, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
My pleasure, Jim. Take care.
My guest has been Martin Straith, founder of Trend News Online at thetrendletter.com. Coming up, Wolf Richter, next on This Week in Money.
Introducing Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB, AMYZF, and Frankfurt 2AM. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
This Week in Money is archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Wolf Richter, publisher of WolfStreet.com. He's speaking to us from San Francisco. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Thanks for having me back, Jim.
Wolf, could the Bank of England be the canary in the coal mine for other central banks?
Well, that was a good one that we got here. You know, the there was a period of chaos in the credit markets in the UK, and it became apparent because the 10-year government bond yield jumped from like 2% in August to 4.5% early this week, and that's a huge gigantic jump. It more than doubled. This is not the Bank of England hasn't even started quantitative tightening yet. It's just barely starting now, and or we're supposed to, and they've have hiked their rates a little bit, but not much. So this was a blowout in the credit markets for the 10-year yield to jump by 2.5 percentage points. That is just crazy. And then on Monday, it got to the point to warn any buyers, and people were expecting it to go to 6 or 7%, essentially just falling apart. And that cost, as we now know, looking back at it, a lot of pension funds, to essentially run into trouble with an investment scheme that they have followed, and that's called a liability-driven investment. And, that is a leveraged investment that's based on derivatives, that use, 10-year long-term government bonds as base, and there's 1.5 trillion pounds in pension funds that did that, and investment banks sold these special liability-driven investment products to those pension funds to make some money in the zero interest return era, and so these were highly leveraged instruments, and essentially they blew up. And so the investment banks asked the pension funds for more collateral, and the pension funds struggled with that. They started selling stocks and bonds and real estate and all kinds of other stuff. And so you had this stuff show up on the market, and some started selling government bonds, and that's when the yields blew out. And so you essentially had the pension fund scheme threatened by this incredible jump in yields, and the pension funds that have to sell to meet the collateral calls, they made it worse by trying to dump government bonds onto a market that wasn't buying them. So the Bank of England stepped in and said, okay, we're going to buy long-dated government bonds for a two-week period and limit to that to settle down the markets. And after, the market settled back down, we're going to sell those. So that's where the Bank of England stands. And it was a reaction to a crisis that was threatening to blow up the big pension funds in the UK. And triggered by this highly leveraged investment that these investment banks sold to the pension funds. And, these crises come out of nowhere these days. There's always something that nobody pays attention to, and it gets big over time. And, you know, the models work fine and everybody's making money and the thing runs smoothly, and then something changes and suddenly the whole thing blows up. And that's what happened with these pension funds and their liability-driven investments. And, that's a huge issue. And so the Bank of England stepped in to solve that by offering to buy, long-dated government bonds in the bond market, which caused those yields to go back down. They're still about 4% for 10-year yields, and it's still very high. So these are very much tighter financial conditions than there were before. This whole episode was likely triggered by the new government's sort of reckless fiscal policies that they established, in this environment where, the UK has 10% inflation. And, so they're coming out with a package of cutting taxes, especially for corporations and for the wealthy, and in addition to subsidies for fuel. So that will blow out the budget and would have to borrow all this money in the market that's already, where the yields are already going up, that's already stressed by inflation, and that caused a kind of a market panic over the last 10 days. And so then we have the spike in yields that's caused the pension funds to threaten to blow up. And so this is a situation that's very unique for this particular instance. I don't know what kind of pension fund problems we'll run into here in the United States and what you might run into in Canada, but that's what the UK ran into. And I know that pension funds are getting leveraged all around because the yields were so low over the past many years that they couldn't really meet their targets. And so they levered up and they got into much riskier investments and they plowed more into stocks and those kinds of things. So as these markets are turning around, we'll see a lot more problems with pension funds. But in the UK, that was the specific case there. And so the Bank of England was very specific about saying that this is not the end of quantitative tightening. This is not QE, what it was doing. It was bailing out the markets for over a two-week period to settle them down. And then it would return to its prior policies. It would sell those bonds that it bought over those 2 weeks, and it would return its prior policies. So that's where the Bank of England stands. In terms of the Fed, in terms of the ECB, the other big central banks that have started tightening, that has no impact. The Fed has come out very strongly, as has the Bank of Canada, in raising its rates recently, and quantitative tightening has started, and it's going. We have yields that are now responding to the Fed's moves. So, I mean, and Fed heads are coming out and saying, the markets are doing what we expect them to do, sort of. And so the Fed is very much in tune with the market's reaction, to its policy hikes. The Fed wants to tighten. We have a big problem with inflation. It's not going away. I mean, it goes up and down. I mean, that's what inflation does. But the fundamentals of this inflation are there, and they're burning, and they're not going away very quickly. I just looked at some labor market data again. I mean, this labor market is really strong. However we look at it, whatever data we look at it, every single item, it says it's really strong. And the Fed keeps pointing that out. And so they will continue to tighten. The Bank of England situation is kind of solved for now. I mean, they calmed down the markets and as far as the Fed is concerned, the Bank of Canada, they're going to pursue the policy goal, which is to bring inflation down. And that's the worst possible thing that could have happened to central bank is this kind of blow up in inflation. They're in charge of inflation. That's the biggest thing they're in charge of. And it broke. And price stability is what they're in charge of. And it broke. It completely broke. That's what they need to get under control, and it sounds like the Bank of England is still focused on that. They are dealing with this crisis, and after the crisis is done with, they're going to return to the inflation fighting mode, and other central banks, I don't think they're going to deviate at all from their projected inflation fighting plans.
What does it say about the Liz Truss government that they say, despite the fact that they almost crashed, their pension funds are going to continue
with the policy set out on their mini budget, tax cuts for the rich and corporations.
Well, this is kind of crazy. You know, it's a new government. They're trying to put their stamp on things. So from a political point of view, you know, I can understand it. And you know, a lot of these politicians have grown up in an era where debt just didn't matter. It just didn't matter how much a government borrowed, you know, and interest rates were forced down by central banks. And now the opposite's the case. You know, the central banks are pushing up interest rates. Inflation is huge all around. And these people that have just moved into government in the UK, you know, aren't willing to come to grips with that. And so they came up with a special little deal, and I think other governments are going to watch this very carefully, because I think the time when deficits don't matter, they're kind of finished. Yeah, deficits do matter now, because borrowing is getting more expensive, and deficit spending is inflationary. So that's going to fuel even more inflation. And, you know, so I think there's a lesson to be learned by other governments when they look at this. And in terms of the UK government, I mean, they're under tremendous pressure to back off and delay those tax cuts. I don't know that they will, but, you know, maybe they find out sort of a compromise. But, you know, that was a gigantic mistake in my view.
We've been hearing predictions of double-digit Fed rates. How hard will it be for central banks to get this inflation under control?
Yeah, that's going to be tough. Yeah, what central banks have today that they didn't have 40 years ago when they fought this type of inflation last time was their balance sheets. Yeah, they have run QE for a long time, so they have all these bloated balance sheets. And they can sell off those assets if they want to. They can let them run off, which is what they're doing now, or they can steepen that by selling them. And that puts a lot of additional pressure on the yields on the markets. And so my theory has always been that this time around they will not have to hike rates as far as they did last time, because those are the short-term rates that they're hiking across. And every central bank, what they're controlling is the short-term rate, and then they're trying to manipulate the long-term rates. And the way they did manipulate the long-term rates down was through QE, through quantitative easing. Now they're doing quantitative tightening, so that's pushing up long-term rates, and we've seen that. And so I think, when inflation started to show up, in early 2021, when I started screaming about it, I thought the Fed would go to 4% with its short-term policy rate and would use quantitative tightening to push up long-term rates. And I stuck to my 4% story for quite a while. And the last few months, I'm backing off of that. So I don't think they will stay at 4%. I think they will go higher. And inflation has gotten worse than I expected. The Fed has gotten pretty aggressive. So it looks like they're going to go over 4%. They may go to 5% even next year. So they'll be over 4% probably by the end of this year, and maybe by 5% sometime next year. But I see very little chance that they will go to double digit. I mean, that's a double digit Fed rate, the federal funds rate, you know, that is not in my scenario. I don't think they need to go that far. I think if they go, 5% and enough quantitative tightening, and give it some time, that will probably bring inflation down. If not, you're going to have to go to 6 or 7% on the short-term rates, by which time the long-term rates will be double digits, you know. But, in terms of the short-term rates that the Fed controls, I just don't see double-digit federal funds rates, you know, at this point. I mean, I might change my mind, but at this point, I think 5% will probably do the job if it's connected to enough quantitative tightening.
Can you give us an update on what's going on with new cars and trucks, and are we finally seeing the end of the supply chain shortages?
Well, to answer your last question first, some of the supply chain shortages are getting better. You know, so the more chips showing up. I mean, the latest thing is just unrelated to semiconductors. You know, the Ford had a problem with a supplier of its Ford Oval that it uses for its pickup trucks. And the supplier got in some kind of trouble, and then had trouble getting the Ford Ovals for it. They used these big ovals that are built into the grill. And, you know, they're decorative, they're big, and they're specially made, and you know, it's this kind of stuff. And in addition to the semiconductors and the other issues, what we're seeing now is, in new vehicles, that the demand has shifted. And that has caused the inventory shortages to shift. So given the high fuel prices, demand has shifted to fuel-efficient vehicles. So these are small vehicles, so compact cars, compact pickup trucks, compact SUVs, EVs, subcompact cars, you know, minivans, those kinds of vehicles. They're essentially gone. There are essentially none left on dealer lots. They come in off the truck. They're already sold before they come in. You know, customer gets called, come in, pick up the vehicle, and it's out. So that's where the inventory shortages are now today, is with the fuel-efficient vehicles. They're sold out, essentially. And, you know, car makers never ordered that many of them because, number one, they're fairly low priced. And so during the chip shortages, they prioritize the expensive vehicles. And two, in normal times, there isn't a lot of demand in North America for these smaller vehicles. So it's just never a huge priority. And the demand is for pickup trucks and SUVs and those vehicles. And so when the demand suddenly was shifted, the supply chain couldn't be adjusted. You know, supply chains are planned long in advance, and they're very long and very complicated. They go all over the world. And so a sudden shift in demand, the way we saw earlier this year when gasoline prices spiked, cannot be accommodated by the supply chain. So now we've got this mismatch. You know, we've got a lot of demand for fuel-efficient vehicles, and they're essentially out. And then we have the trucks, especially the pickup trucks and full-size SUVs, and demand has slowed down a lot for those. And especially for Ram pickup trucks, so the Ram dealers are full of inventory. They're starting to make deals now: $8,000 off, $6,000 off MSRP in the United States, now $10,000 off some of the bigger ones. There's all kinds of factory programs on it, national and regional, and incentives. Now dealers make deals, so if you're looking for a Ram truck, there should be plenty out there, and you should be able to get a deal. That's not necessarily the case with some of the other truck lines, but across the product line of what is now Stellantis, so Ram, Jeep, Dodge, Chrysler, they all are either amply stocked or overstocked in inventory. And, you know, so they're in that corner, there really aren't any shortages anymore. Ford should have plenty of vehicles on most of its models. GM, the same thing. And there's more vehicles coming in now. The brands that are really in short supply are the brands that are building fuel-efficient vehicles in the United States, and that's in the shortest supply, and that's Kia, Toyota, Honda, you know, Lexus, Subaru, Honda, you know, the BMW, too, to some extent. These are the brands where you essentially have to order and wait and for your vehicle to come in. So the picture has shifted dramatically from last year. Last year it was, the inventories were out of pickup trucks and large SUVs. Everybody wanted them. The automakers were prioritizing their most expensive models, most expensive versions. And, the pickup trucks cost nearly $100,000, just flew off the shelves with a bus sticker pricing. And that's out the door. I mean, that is finished. We no longer see that. The pickup trucks, you should be able to get deals on them. And, there should be plenty of inventory now, especially with Ram, vehicles. But also starting to see good inventory with Ford and GM products. So, But if you're looking for a fuel-efficient vehicle, it's going to be tough. You know, you're going to have to order and wait.
What's the latest on the prices of used vehicles?
So, used vehicles did something I never, ever thought I would ever see, which is, prices spiked by 40%, so that's 40% over a 12-month period through last year, and that was just ridiculous. And at some point late last year, early this year, buyers just went on a buyer's strike. And I've been advocating for that for a while. If you're enough to buy a vehicle at these kinds of prices. And so now sales volume has dropped sharply. There's plenty of supply. But at these prices, there's just a lot of resistance out there now. And so what we've seen is that at the auctions, so these are wholesale prices, the wholesale prices have come down by about 12% on used vehicles and since the peak in December. And that's a lot. You know, that's a big drop, and that's adjusted for mileage and for the age of the vehicle, those kinds of things. So that's an index based on the volume that goes through the largest auction house in North America. So that's Mannheim that's doing that. And that's a big drop. But they have jumped up so far on the wholesale pricing that compared to 2019, wholesale prices are still 50% higher. So, they have come down a lot, but they just haven't come down enough. And 50% price increases over the period since 2019 is gigantic. And we can't really compare them to last year because we already had these price spikes last year. So there is still a lot of resistance out there. Prices have come down on the retail side a little bit, but not much. They've been very sticky so far this year. But they're down, but they're not down enough. And so dealers are starting to sit on vehicles. But they've got a certain cost in those, and they're reluctant to make deals. And they're not really encouraged to make deals because they don't have a lot of supply coming in. So, that's the other side of the used vehicle business. The rental cars are supplying 2 to 3 million used vehicles to the used vehicle market every year. And the rental cars companies haven't been able to get new vehicles to the extent that they normally do. So they keep their stuff longer and it's older and less often comes out of inventory. So they have not supplied the wholesale market with the number of vehicles that they normally do. So there's less supply going into the wholesale market, and dealers are seeing that. They know that the pipeline really isn't chock full with cars, and so they're not really incentivized to cut their prices at this point. So there's some of that is happening, but they're being very careful about it. So I think used vehicle prices are going to prove to be fairly sticky. They need to come down further. I mean, Americans have just, they've got kind of burned out on those prices. But, but every time they go down a little bit, there's more buyers coming out. So, I think this is still a very bad time to buy a used vehicle. I just recommend if you can afford not to buy one, if you can drive what you have for another year or two, that's what I will do. And I would let this stuff settle down a little bit.
Are high gasoline prices enticing people to buy electric vehicles in the Vancouver area? We're paying about $2.40 a liter, or about $9 per American gallon right now.
That's a lot of money, $9. I mean, even in San Francisco, we, at our rip-off tourist gas station here down the block, we pay $6. and that will cause a revolt in Texas. So if they have to pay $6 at their station down there, so $9, that's a lot. But even here, at our gas prices, there's a lot of demand for EVs. The problem is you can't get them. They're sold out. There are huge waiting lists to buy them. So you can get your name on the waiting list and hope for the best. So we don't really know even what demand is. So if there were an unlimited supply of EVs, what would demand look like? So you would take the first batch of demand off, you know, the first, you know, 500,000 people that want an EV, and if there's still any demand left after that. And so we don't know, you know, this is something we just really don't know, because we have such a huge supply issues, not just EVs, but across the board with vehicles that have a good fuel economy. So, it's hybrids are sold out. It's the whole slew of things, you know. So our EVs are, right now, are waiting list vehicles. You know, you put your name on a list and you hope you get one. And, production has ramped up, but they're constrained. Also, chip shortages, you know, lithium is very high. Battery supply chains are still not ramped up. I mean, this whole EV era has an entirely different supply chain, you know, than the ICE vehicles. So, yeah, especially on the battery side, you know, they have to ramp up to this kind of volume, and so there continue to be constraints beyond the semiconductors that will impact the industry. But so far as we know now, as we look, demand far exceeds supply, and we don't really know how deep the demand is. We can't measure it, you know, but it's far bigger than the supply that we've got coming out right now.
How's the housing market doing in the U.S.?
Well, Canada leads, the United States follows. That's what it looks like to me, and in part due to our mortgage rate. Our benchmark mortgage rate is a 30-year fixed rate mortgage, which means the rates are based on long-term bond rates on the 10-year treasury. And the 10-year treasury yield has not moved up as much as short-term rates. So that has kept mortgage rates from rising more slowly in the United States, even though they have now jumped tremendously. In Canada, you're more linked to short-term rates. So if you're variable rate mortgages and you're fixed rate mortgages that are fixed for only a certain period of time. And so our mortgage market didn't respond quite as quickly as yours. But now we have 7%. 30-year fixed-rate mortgages. 7% is huge. We went through the 6% mark in June, and so now we're at 7%, and that makes it nearly impossible for a lot of people to buy a house at these prices, and so they have left the market. Sales have plunged across the board, and prices, you know, sellers have pulled the properties off the market because they're waiting for better times, you know, and if they can outwait it, they're going to try. So we have a market that has, you know, the sort of feel of a frozen market where sellers don't want to sell and because they can't get what they want, and buyers are not showing up to buy because, you know, at these mortgage rates, they need to have much, 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 much lower price. And then so what is selling, so at the relatively low volumes, you know, we're now seeing, what is selling is coming down in price, is coming down pretty hard. And in the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area, for example, we have already dropped below a year ago in terms of the median price, in terms of the Case-Shiller Price Index, which tracks not median price-based, but it tracks the same house, and when it sells over time, so it's a little bit more accurate maybe in tracking prices, and it's less distorted by changes in mix. Well, this is now coming down very hard. It lags 3 or 4 or 5 months behind because of the way it's set up, but it is now coming down very hard and so for July, that's the last month we had, and it's a 3-month moving average. It's really major in July. It came down 3.5% from the prior month in San Francisco, Bay Area, 5-county Bay Area. And that was the biggest drop since the housing bust and since 2012. And in other markets, the same thing in Seattle and other markets, you know, they've experienced, on this index, they've experienced the steepest drop since the housing bust. And so this is something that doesn't occur regularly. You know, we haven't seen those drops since back then. So it has started. The reality on the ground has been that way for months, but now we're seeing it show up in the most reliable data. And it, that's based on mortgage rates that were below 7%, that were in the 6% range. So now we're going forward, we're dealing with mortgages in the 7% range. So this is just going to get worse, and worse meaning you look at the spike, the price spike, you know. So, you know, we've had 40% price increase in some like 2 years, and so, or more, you know, and so if you unwind that 2 year price spike, that's a big chunk, but not many people actually bought homes during that time. So for most home buyers that bought before then, there is really no big change. It's just an illusion that went away. And, yeah, for a very small number of home buyers that bought during those 2 years, obviously they're going to be underwater. And, if we unwind the price spike, and that's kind of what we're looking at here. You know, we've had such a huge price spike that the drops right now are fairly, you know, they're large and they're fast. And, you know, but we have these spikes that go up. So it sort of goes down at the same speed that it went up. And it's fairly symmetrical at this point. And, you know, I don't know where this is going to go, but it has to go to a place where these homes become affordable and for people to buy at higher mortgage rates, and we're far from that.
From the outside looking in, how is Canada's housing market doing?
Yeah, like I said, you guys are a little ahead of us. Yeah, I mean, in the big markets, the Vancouver area and the Toronto area are the same problem, you know, sales volume way down and prices started to drop, significant price drops, that's the trend, you know, there's not just a little dip, they're starting to unwind the incredible price spike that these markets experienced in the prior 2 years. So, I mean, it's really, from a macroeconomic point of view, it's really not a lot to worry about if you unwind 2 years' worth of price spike. You know, there's not a lot of damage being done here because only a relatively small portion of Canadian homeowners actually bought homes during that time. And, it's pretty bad for those people that bought it at the peak, but, you know, that happens, and you're just going to have to live in the house for a while and make your payments until things change. And the idea that you can make lots of money in real estate may have to be forgotten and replaced by the old idea that real estate is that a house is an expense, you know, that costs you money over time, and it's a place to live in and enjoy and you know, raise a family in or whatever, but you invest your money in other things, and the house is an expense. And, you know, the Japanese have been looking at this for decades. You know, they've had declining home prices and stagnating home prices for a very long time. And, you know, they come to grips with the fact that a house, a home, a condo is an expense. You know, it's not an investment. It's not anything you're going to make money with. It's a place you live in and you enjoy and be happy in. And from that point of view, you know, I think most Canadian and most American home buyers that bought, you know, several years ago, or 20 years ago, or 30 years ago, they'll be just fine.
Wolf, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Thank you, Jim.
My guest has been Wolf Richter, publisher of WolfStreet.com. He was speaking to us from San Francisco. And that wraps up our show for this week. We'd like to thank our guests, Ross Clark, Martin Straith, and Wolf Richter. And thank you for listening. If you have any questions for the show or our guests, you can send them to info@howstreet.com. Now stand by for a company showcase update from Shaheem Ali, Chief Financial Officer of Recyclical Battery Materials Incorporated, formerly known as American Manganese. I'm Jim Goddard. We'll be back next week with more This Week in Money.
Comments made on This Week in Money are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any manner whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. This Week in Money is a production of How Street Media Incorporated. Executive producer is Tom Allen. Welcome to Company Showcase, an advertising feature on HowStreet.com.
I'm Jim Goddard. My guest is Shaheem Ali, Chief Financial Officer of Recyclical, formerly American Manganese. Shaheem, welcome back to Company Showcase.
Thank you, Jim.
Shaheem, you just came back from New York from a huge conference. Can you tell us about it and what it means to Recyclical?
Sure, Jim. Thank you. Zach and I got back last night from New York, and we attended a EV and battery event. And then from there, we had several meetings throughout the week. The event was one day, but we had meetings booked out from the event. And we made personal contacts with some other groups over there while we were there. We met with fund EV sector analysts. And these are guys who cover EV battery space. And, you know, it's important for us that we get in front of these guys and grill our technology and how we have positioned ourselves towards commercialization. So this is good people, people that we want to be in front of. And, you know, while we are there, we also met and had appointments with a few investment banking groups. You know, people ask us, why do you have to keep meeting with these guys when you don't need money? That is true. We don't need money now. However, it is very important for us that when the time is right to seek funding, we are in front of the right guys. And it takes time to build relationship with these funds and their the accounts that they manage. So it is important that we keep doing what we need to do with investment banking group. And if we come across a JV or some kind of offtake agreement, we have the right people behind us to back our project. And, you know, also the fact that investment banking community, they provide long-term shareholders, investors too, right? While we are there, we also met with a few investor relations, corporate marketing firms, and being in front or having meetings with them, it allows them to look from a different vantage point. They look at us, they audit our marketing plans, they question on us, on our business plan, our strategy, and it provides us some kind of audit on our strategies and what we are doing, how we are doing, our execution plans. And if of value, they provide us services to move our company forward. And it is needed in this kind of climate right now. If you look at the market conditions, all of these that I said above are very much needed. You know, our last days of the visit, we visited a gigafactory in New York that is under construction. And we visited a facility that has been testing with our materials to validate them. Hopefully in a week or two, we will have some results. And we look forward to sharing with that with our families and shareholders and everyone in our network pool. Also, I get asked, I always get asked, oh, I'd like to share what is happening in the next couple of weeks here at Recyclico. Our name change has been accepted by Exchange. It took us a long time, but given the holidays and the person who was managing our account, finally we can officially use the name Recyclico Battery Materials, Inc. Our press release will have more information out there about the QCIP number and the details that matters to our shareholders. A change of business from mining issuer to industrial technology issuer will be planned from here now, hopefully by next EGM, but that is the next step. However, we are officially Recyclico Battery Materials, Inc., and that is important to us because we do not want to be seen as a mining American Manganese or company that holds mining properties rather than battery material space. Our website has gone through a refresh, but we will keep working on it. However, if you go to our website, it will display all our current information with our new name. Also, I know our visitors want a deal in place, and we are continuously working towards one. But it is important that we get into the right deal that makes sense for our shareholders and increase our shareholder value. We just can't get into any deal. I mean, some of the deals that come our way, given the situation today, you know, some ask for a 70% stake in the company. Some ask for a licensing right for not much. Or some require us to show us our blueprint before they want on to proceed any talks. So we have to be careful and we have to navigate through these asks before we can put something on the dotted line. However, Our business model requires extensive testing of third-party materials, and this is done so that we minimize execution risk. And that is important, and this is why hopefully by end of this year we can do some kind of disclosure on the progress on our demonstration plant so that we can share more information towards it. But I am confident more than ever in our lab that we are doing it right. Jim, today in Canada, I know we are marking the National Truth and Reconciliation Day. My heart goes out to families that suffered the abuse and ongoing emotional trauma. I also want to take this day to pour my heart and share my thoughts with our shareholders who are family to us here at American Magnesium. That's how Larry saw everyone here, and that's how we see it. I know our share price has been under pressure. It pains me too, as my family and friends are suffering losses, experiencing this decline in share price. However, we see this has to do with, partly with to do with a warrant exercise that has coming up on October 2nd. The stock market sentiment is not helping Jim here. You know, some are selling because they see that Larry is no longer here to carry the vision. He did have a huge following too. So, you know, perhaps the most disturbing part of this and chatter on the boards are that Larry's family will start selling their positions. You know, as a public company, it is our responsibility to ensure that all areas of business, technical know-how, the succession planning are all in place. And Larry did a good job on mentoring us over here and preparing us for that day. Now, kudos, Larry. It's just amazing job he has done, and we want to keep doing what we are doing. We are working up the same blueprint, and just the faces have changed, that's all. But the blueprint, the processes, the systems, the know-how, the vision will all be carried out as planned. To some of it matters as I speak to you. Larry holds approximately less than 2% of the outstanding shares. You know, it takes time for shares to transfer. It has to go through a process, probate, wills, and etc. So it takes time for them to transfer. To go out there and irresponsibly mark that Larry's family is dumping shares and create some kind of fee in the market, that's not smart. You know. Also, I ask our shareholders, think about it. As we sit today, we have about $75 million in market cap at 30 cents. Does it really justify our valuation? You be the judge. A company with $20 million in the bank, valued at a market cap of $75 million at 30 cents. You know, I'd like to ask all our listeners to be patient with us. Please believe in us. I'd like to ask everyone to have a good weekend, and let's promote recycling for a better tomorrow.
Shaheem, where can people get more information about the company, and where are you traded?
You can visit our website, AmericanManganeseInc.com. It will be changing very soon to recyclico.com. You can call us at 778-574-4444 or email us at investorservices@amymn.com. We are listed on TSX Venture Exchange, AMY.V, on OTCQB, AMYZF, and 2 a.m. on Frankfurt Exchange.
Shaheem, thank you so much for the update.
Thank you, Jim.
My guest has been Shaheem Ali, Chief Financial Officer of Recyclical Battery Materials Incorporated, formerly American Manganese. Our conversation took place on September 30th. I'm Jim Goddard.
Comments made on Company Showcase are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any manner whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Archived online at HowStreet.com. Company Showcase is a production of How Street Media Incorporated.